Welcome to UK Health Radio. You are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show hosted by Shamina Rabi, a consultant speech and language therapist and founder of Unlocking Language, an award-winning independent practice that provides speech and language therapy to both adults and children. She is dedicated to raising awareness about speech, language, communication and swallowing difficulties and empowering those who have them.
A huge welcome to UK Health Radio, and I am Shamina Rabi, a speech and language therapist hosting the Speech and Language Therapy Show. In today's episode, we will be discussing PMLD and more specifically in relation to communication, eating and drinking difficulties. PMLD stands for Profound Multiple Learning Disabilities, and this is when someone has complex learning needs. In addition to their severe learning difficulties, they may have other significant difficulties, such as physical disabilities, sensory impairment, or a severe medical condition. There is no accepted definition of profound and multiple learning disabilities, but it is commonly associated with pronounced developmental delay, with significant physical and sensory impairments, and epilepsy. So today, I would love to welcome on my show, Alana Wager, speech and language therapist with a clinical speciality in working with children with complex and multiple disabilities, as well as children who are medically fragile. She holds bachelor's and master's degrees in speech language pathology from her native USA and is a former US Fulbright Fellow to the Netherlands. She is passionate about advocating for a kinder and more accepting world for children with profound and multiple disabilities and currently works at Unlocking Language in London. Hi, Alana.
Hi.
That's a very impressive CV.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So thank you for coming and sharing your expertise on what you do with PMLD children and young adults.
Yes.
And I think we'd all love to know a little bit more about what is PMLD and how as speech language therapists we work in such a niche field. Right. I'd say it's niche.
Yeah, I would definitely say so as well. So for me, I became really interested in working with children with PMLD in graduate school, actually. Mm-hmm. So when I had my first patients. And I think that for me, like so many therapists, they were the first patients that really sort of caught me off guard and made me think in a really different way. You know, I've learned, like many students, how to use and administer particular assessments or deliver therapy in what I thought was, you know, this prescribed way. And then having my first patients with PMLD, kind of having to put on a different clinical hat and think really critically about how I was going to provide good care to those patients. So that's why I love PMLD. That's how I got interested into it.
Fantastic. Because there are a very small number of speech therapists working in the field of PMLD.
Absolutely.
As speech therapists, even though the communication needs are so significant.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really interesting. And truthfully, I can't explain that because I think that the need is so, so profound. Mm. I think maybe it has to do something with educational access. So I think it's difficult from what I've heard chatting with my UK colleagues, it's difficult as a student, if you're really interested in that, to maybe find a student placement that will accept students and kind of offer that mentored learning experience. So I think that can be a barrier for sure.
Okay, interesting. So I guess for our listeners who are tuned in today, perhaps starting from the beginning, I know I talked a little bit about what PMLD is, but if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. So when I think of PMLD, the way that I really think about that clinically are children that cannot be explained by one diagnosis alone. Mm-hmm. So for example, the patients that may have autism, epilepsy, chromosomal abnormality and a genetic mutation. That is an example of a PMLD patient. So a pretty tall order and definitely a lot of involvements. And
okay.
I think that can be a challenge, but also something really rewarding to working with these patients is figuring out what will work with respect to all of the plates they're juggling.
And what are the characteristics of a child with PMLD?
Yeah, so typically when we're talking about children with PMLD, we see a pretty profound cognitive deficit. We usually will see profound impairments in terms of communication across the board. So it's very common for these patients to not have any verbal speech at all, and many times no means of functional communication.
So what is communication to you?
Yeah, so communication for me really means being able to advocate and explain for oneself. I think even in the most basic of senses. So being able to communicate likes and dislikes, being able to ask for things that we need, right? Being able to really engage and participate in the world around us. And I think for so many of our kids with PMLD, that's one of the reasons why our therapy is so crucial, because we're helping to establish those skills that many of us take for granted.
And how do people with PMLD communicate?
Yeah, so mostly with our kids with PMLD, we don't see a whole lot of verbal speech. Sometimes we do, and when we do, that's amazing. But we see it through a variety of ways. So we see it through changing body posturing, right? Changing the movement of their face, their lips, their eyebrows even, using their hands to communicate. Of course, facial expressions. We also have gesture use, and some of our patients that have received prior speech and language therapy might have a system like PECS or eye gaze or another AAC system in place to communicate.
Okay, so just stepping back a little bit again, could you give us some examples of developmental disabilities?
Sure.
In terms of conditions and diagnoses?
Yeah, absolutely. So developmental disabilities would pretty much include autism, Down syndrome, any type of chromosomal abnormality that you might think of, any type of genetic condition, and then also individuals who have neurological conditions. So okay. Any type of brain damage, or if there's been an issue in brain development. Over time, we can sometimes see our patients with epilepsy, especially if it's not well controlled, will obtain brain damage, which might result in a higher presentation of their symptoms with PMLD, for example.
It sounds like they do have quite severe medical conditions that impact on the physical, the sensory, the learning difficulties.
Sure.
How do you then assess children who already have such limited communication?
Yeah, so I think that this is really where sort of this holistic approach comes into play, because definitely when we're assessing these kids, we need to be communicating with the parents, with the families, with the pediatrician, with anyone that spends time with the child on a regular basis to figure out, you know, what are their baseline skills look like? How does their mom know, for example, if they're hungry or they need to use the bathroom? Nine times out of 10, I always start with moms, because they're usually the best reporters and sources of information.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. So I would say a PMLD assessment is definitely not something you can do in clinic in isolation or in a school in isolation. It's really critical to find how that child is communicating with the people around them, and then thinking about how might they need to communicate with the people around them. Right. So most of my assessments are very functionally based.
Okay.
So thinking about, okay, for example, does the child have a means of clearly communicating whether they want or don't want something? And if not, then that's where I'll start. So, for example, by presenting a variety of items that I've figured out that the child does like, either through an interview with a parent or a teacher, presenting them and seeing, how is this child going to tell me that they want this item, for example. Mm-hmm. And then moving into, a lot of times when we assess these kiddos, they have refusal behaviors such as slapping things away or pushing things away or just getting up and walking away from items or activities that they don't want to engage in.
Okay.
So looking at, okay, how can we replace that with a more socially and contextually appropriate form of refusal. Yeah.
Good. Okay. So tying in with that, what are some of the biggest barriers to interaction and communication for these children?
Great question. So I would say for most of these kids, the biggest barriers there, I would say there's two main categories. The first being physical barriers, right? So the kids that have, for example, tracheostomy tubes in place and that can't vocalize using their voice, or that might not have the motor mobility and control to formulate verbal speech, or to even use their upper limbs to, for example, communicate with pecs or exchange a symbol. So those physical barriers are certainly in place. But then also, a lot of times I find there's huge opportunity barriers in place for these kids. So I think it can be really easy for the average person, when they meet someone with profound and multiple disabilities, to make an ignorant assumption about what they can or cannot do or understand. And so sometimes I've found that with my patients, they will be in a situation, for example, throughout the school day, where they actually are trying to communicate with the staff around them, maybe by raising their eyebrows when they want more of something, or by making a certain facial grimace or movement when they don't like something. But everyone is already so, you know, prescribed to this idea that they don't understand what's going on around them, that people aren't really looking for those cues. So I definitely say that's something really crucial when working with PMLD, to just tune into everything that the child is doing.
That's very interesting. And is that something that you would recommend to new mums and dads who may have a baby or a toddler that's been diagnosed with PMLD?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would definitely say for these parents, it's really important to trust your gut.
Okay.
So if you feel like your child is, for example, moving their face in a certain way or posturing their body or doing whatever the behavior might be, and you feel like they're doing that to communicate with you,
it's a meaningful interactional communication.
Exactly. And they're doing that consistently with purpose, trust your gut and communicate that with the other people that are working with your child, right? So that's a great thing parents can do to help promote the child's progress overall. So if you're seeing that at home, the child is, for example, moving their hand in a certain way, maybe twisting their wrist, for example, I've seen a patient do this to indicate yes, right? Communicate that with the nursery and preschool staff so that they know that means yes, and then they can reinforce it. Because what we don't want to do is we don't want to not respond appropriately to the child when they're trying to communicate with us, right?
Yeah,
because we're really trying to reinforce that communication is meaningful. It's worth the time and effort.
Yeah.
And you're going to get something out of it.
Excellent. And so at the moment you work in a special school, is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And how many children with PMLD are in the school?
So I have, between the settings I work in, I have about a total of 150 children with PMLD on my caseload.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a huge number.
Yeah. So we're busy, but it's great.
Okay, excellent. And so you've spoken about communication, which I'd like to come back to in a few minutes. But can you elaborate slightly on your role with eating and drinking?
Sure. So as a speech and language therapist, we also work to support feeding, swallowing, and eating and drinking.
Yes,
children.
We do.
And particularly with children with PMLD, this is really important, because something like 60% of children with profound and multiple learning disabilities will have some type of difficulty feeding themselves orally. And so that can be broken down in a myriad of ways. So it could just be, for example, the child who presents like a picky eater, right? So the child that has a sensory feeding involvement where they're only eating, I call it the Trinity, beige, brown, and dry.
Right? Okay, great.
Beige, brown, and dry foods. So like those crackers, biscuits, chicken nuggets, right? Crisps, french fries, as we call them in the US, things like that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have sort of more organic and medical involvements when we see organic dysphagia, right? So medically caused dysphagia, which is extremely, extremely common in PMLD, actually. Many of our children with PMLD will have some type of nutritional assistance.
Okay.
So whether that's, it's usually through a tube feed. So they can have, most of the tubes that are placed long-term would be G-tubes. That's what we see mostly here in the UK.
Okay.
And essentially it's a means of supplementing nutrition for people who aren't able to safely eat by mouth. So really my role in my time with these patients as well, is to also make sure that they are safe in their eating and drinking orally, and to look at ways that we can perhaps modify their diet or environment to make sure that they are safe.
That's really okay. So going back a step again to communication, are there any main approaches that you do use with PMLD? I know when I've come across young children or older children in this category, I've seen therapists use intensive interaction or object for reference.
Absolutely.
So I think it'd be useful if we could just elaborate perhaps a little bit more on some of the core evidence-based type practices that are out there that either teachers are listening to us today, or parents that could perhaps find out a little bit more about what they are and then try it out.
Sure, yeah. So absolutely, like you said, intensive interaction is a great one. So that's an approach basically where the focus is on the communication partner interacting with the child. And I always refer to it as being the child's mirror and their echo. So we're making the same movements that they're making. We're making the same sounds that they're making. And essentially the focus of this approach is to engage the child in communication in a meaningful way that is child directed, right?
Okay.
So very naturalistic, and it's also non-intimidating. So we're interacting with the child doing something that they like, right? And I think that's crucial. Another approach which I like to use.
And can I just say, when I think of intensive interaction, I always think of it where you're entering the child's world. You're entering his or her world.
Absolutely.
You're playing with him or her the way that they are playing or they want to play.
Exactly.
And I think it's a great way for the child to lead rather than us always having to give the instruction or wanting the child to follow what we're doing.
Absolutely.
But actually we're just joining in with what they're doing and following their lead.
I completely agree. And I think it's interesting, right, because I think so often when we work with children with disabilities, we have this idea of what we want them to do and what we think a fun and appropriate social interaction
absolutely
looks like, right? So, you know, sit down with me and look at me in the eye and let's play this game together, right? But for our children with PMLD, you know, if sitting on, for example, a beanbag and rocking and making a particular noise that they find enjoyable, if that's pleasurable for them, then we're going to get way more out of entering, like you said, their world and engaging in that space with them than, for example, trying to force them to sit down and engage in some other obscure activity with us.
And I think intensive interaction is a really good practice to use across different kind of groups that we have who come for speech and language therapy, such as autism, even ones that are not as low level
or
go under severe complex needs.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, even doing it with children where you sort of follow their lead and enter their world again.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, intensive interaction is a great one. And I think the great thing about it too is that it's an approach that is not material intensive at all, right? You don't need any materials to engage in intensive interaction. It's not cost intensive, right? You don't need to spend any money. And parents, caregivers can do it very frequently, as can school staff. I think even if, you know, for example, you have a young child and whoever is taking care of them, whether it's their nursery setting or, for example, if you have a babysitter that isn't necessarily trained to work with children with complex needs, that's fine. They can quite easily learn how to engage in intensive interaction. So I think that's a great one.
And it's interesting because when you do have babies, you do often enter their world. If they're cooing, you coo like them.
Right.
If they're making sounds, you make sounds like them.
Sure.
If they make a certain facial expression, you do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Because you want to see how do they respond to that.
Yeah.
Just so you can both have a communication opportunity and share some
Absolutely.
Communication together.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Great. So what were the other practices that you would like to talk a little bit more about?
So the other approaches that I really enjoy, so intensive interaction is definitely one.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other, just in general, is using a naturalistic and total communication approach.
Okay.
So when we talk about naturalistic settings, basically a fancy way of saying that, again, we're going to let the child lead. So we're going to follow their interests completely, and we're going to let them take charge of the interaction. And research really shows us that for our kids with PMLD, that is what is effective, right? So, you know, discrete trials and highly structured activities, these are not going to be the activities that are really meaningful and enjoyable for our children with PMLD. So letting them lead. And then also, I think definitely, you know, this idea of a total communication approach. So like I mentioned earlier, with paying attention to the body posturing, right, the facial positioning, everything about the child's being that could be intentionally communicative. I think it can be really easy, especially, you know, in our world of speech and language therapy, where everything is measured and pre-prescribed, right? And we have, we can have these very specific ideas about how we want children to communicate and behave. I think it's easy to lose sight of communication as being a whole concept rather than a discrete skill. So the example I always use with this is PECS, right? Okay. So I think PECS is an incredible system, and it's really effective for many, many children in helping them communicate.
And PECS stands for
Picture Exchange Communication System. So, you know, I love PECS, but I think one thing that can be difficult is for children with PMLD specifically, when PECS is introduced, sometimes everything else is then taken away. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I have seen this, right? So a child beginning to use PECS, they're establishing some skills with their ability to use the pictures and exchange symbols to communicate wants and needs. Then, for example, the child might verbalize or might make a gesture, and that is now being perhaps ignored in favor of PECS. So that's something for me personally, I don't use. I use a total communication approach. So any form of communication that is recognizable and that is not dangerous to the child or others, I accept, especially in those preliminary phases of therapy where we're really trying to establish functional communication.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, I do think there is a place for PECS, and PECS is great. And like you said, that should keep going if the child is using that, but don't forget.
Sure,
don't
exactly.
forget to still use that total communication approach.
Absolutely.
Looking to see what is the facial expression. Can they
Absolutely.
Use another way to express what they want in addition to
Absolutely,
PECS.
Absolutely. And I think that's the important thing to remember. And poor PECS is getting picked on.
Because we do love PECS.
We love PECS. We definitely love our PECS. We use it a lot. So for example, right, like forgetting that idea of we're teaching communication and PECS is a route to get there. And
that's
I think
right.
sometimes, right, and that's like what PECS protocol says, right? But I think it can be misconstrued by people that may have not had the training or exposure as being, okay, PECS mastery is the end goal. So we're going to forget about all other types of communication.
So there's a couple of really useful approaches, Alana. So I often hear therapists using objects of reference.
Right.
And I think that would be quite useful for using that in schools, at home.
Yep.
Is that something you can talk about a little bit more?
Sure, yeah. So objects of reference are a really popular way to begin communication with children with PMLD. Mm. And basically what they are just objects that stand for something else, right? So usually, for example, we'll begin with objects of reference for things that are concrete. So for example, the bathroom, right? Or dinner time. These can be used to help facilitate transitions and also increase the child's understanding of what is going to be going on in their school day, what can they expect.
Okay.
And so the objects can be anything really, and they just reference the actual event. So for example, in a lot of my schools for dinner time, we'll give the student a spoon, right? For swimming time, a lot of my kids do hydrotherapy. So they'll have, for example, a little plastic bag with some blue hair gel in it that they can squeeze, right? To kind of signify, and you're getting that multi-sensory input, right? So you're touching something, you can see it, you can feel it, sometimes you can hear it if there's an auditory property. But it's basically a way of signifying to the child that something is going to be changing in their environment.
And when would you introduce the object of reference in relation to the activity? Would it be 5 or 10 minutes before?
Yeah,
or quite
exactly.
early on in the day?
Exactly. No, so for me, I usually introduce them about 5 minutes before the transition will take place. And the reason for that is I think it would be quite cognitively demanding on a child to expect them to be able to reference, for example, a whole schedule or array of objects of reference, and then later like remember the sequential order and recall all those things.
Are there any examples that parents could be using at home for object of reference?
Yeah, absolutely. So some examples parents could use at home, like I said, in school, for example, might be a spoon to signify that it's time for a meal. Parents can also, I've had parents use a nappy and give it to the child right before they're about to be changed. They know that they can anticipate that, especially as children with PMLD get older and still might not be continent and they do need to be changed. That can be an upsetting time.
Okay.
It's a real difficult transition for a lot of my kids. So I find that object works well then. Another one is bedtime, right? So I've had parents use like a piece of cloth or, for example, like an old pillowcase to signify to the child that it'll be time to go to sleep. Other ones include, for example, a mini car. To signify it's time to go for a ride in the car. What I like better, if you can find it, is actually like the seatbelt material. I think it's a bit more concrete.
Okay.
So they're great. And it's something, again, you can use at home, and the objects can be very small. They don't need to be fancy. And I think the key takeaway with objects of reference is that they don't need to be miniature representations of whatever it is that the child's going to engage in. Does that make sense? So I think sometimes I've had parents say to me, okay, you know, we have hydrotherapy or time in the pool, but I can't find a miniature pool. What am I to do? And it doesn't have to be that. It's just anything that will consistently be used.
And the association with the activity.
Absolutely. So the closer, the more sensory properties you can get in line with the referent, the better.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly, you don't have to be finding miniature, you know, objects to relate to everything in the child's life.
So something I've come across when I've gone to do some school visits are these children will have communication passports, and I think that's been a fantastic way to present the person in a really positive manner, and it draws together information from their past and their present, and it really gets you to know their personality and that this is a really unique person.
Yeah, absolutely. So communication passports are so great. I love them for my patients, and I think there's something parents can make, right? So a communication passport is basically what it sounds like. It's a little document, a little passport that tells other people how your child communicates, and your child can use that. It's particularly useful if your child's not yet using a recognizable form of communication, mm-hmm. right? So for example, the child who might raise their eyebrows to indicate yes, or maybe might move their lips in a different way to indicate no. For an unfamiliar communication partner, they might have no idea what your child means. Mm. But if your child has a communication passport that quite easily spells out what their behaviors indicate communicatively, it can be really useful. And another thing that's really sweet, like you mentioned, is a lot of my patients in their communication passports will have little things about them, for example, that indicate when they're enjoying an activity or when they might be joking around or when they might not be too happy with something.
And this is something that parents can introduce quite early on, and I'm assuming would change as the child is evolving like everyone else does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the great part is, you know, you can make one for your child today. You can make it on Microsoft Word, right? There's no format you need to follow, just whatever information you know about the way your child communicates that would help someone unfamiliar be able to better understand them.
What are the four or five key things that you would find in a communication passport?
So typically we'd find information about the child's diagnosis, mm-hmm. right? So overall, what's going on with that child. The second would be what the child is able to express, what information they're able to convey. The third would be what they're able to understand, right? The fourth is usually what communication methods the child uses. So that would be the little section where, you know, the behaviors might be listed out, or for example, something like if the child's proficient in Makaton sign, for example, that could be written there.
Okay.
And then the fifth part is usually what can the communication partner do?
How can I communicate?
And then also, how can you communicate with me?
Okay.
Right? And I think that so often is, like we were talking earlier about opportunity barriers. I think that's one of the biggest opportunity barriers for our kids with PMLD in developing their skills, is that in general, right, the general public does not yet know how to communicate. with someone with profound and multiple disabilities.
I agree, and I always feel there's an element of fear.
Yes.
They don't know how to do it and what to do, so I just won't talk to that person.
Absolutely.
It's the fear of the unknown, which is natural. It's a natural feeling to have.
Absolutely.
And I think as speech therapists, what we want to do is to promote positivity in being able to have that communication or that interaction, but also empower the other person.
Absolutely.
With the person with PMLD.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And I think it's something that our kids with PMLD often run into, right? So they'll be in school or in a community setting, for example, mm-hmm. and someone might say, oh, so-and-so communicates with Makaton. And then suddenly all the adults that are unfamiliar in that child's world may assume that because they're not proficient in Makaton, they can't engage or interact with this child at all, right? Which we know to not be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the communication passport is brilliant for helping to navigate that.
So once the other person on the other side of the conversation does have a look at the communication passport, mm-hmm. well, let's say there's no communication passport and, you know, mm-hmm. they've met somebody with PMLD sure. on a wheelchair with a family member in a shop. How would you empower them to be able to take that first step towards having a conversation or interacting?
It's a great question. And I think my number one tip, right, is to not be afraid. Right? Kids with profound and multiple disabilities want the same things that you and I want.
Yeah,
okay. They want to create meaningful connections with other people. They want to chat. They want to talk about their day.
Mm-hmm.
They might not be able to yet, but fundamentally, that desire for inclusion and meaningful interaction is still there. And I think that is the biggest barrier, right? So for unfamiliar communication partners, kind of thinking like, oh gosh, you know, this child's in a wheelchair and they don't speak verbally. How can I, you know, what do I do? What can I say? And my tip to the general public would be just say hi, right? Start with hello. It's a really great program that started in the United States to advocate for inclusion in the schools and also a sort of an anti-bullying.
Just say hello. I love that.
Yeah, so just kind of like an anti-bullying campaign, but the slogan applies perfectly. So just say hello, you know, the same way you would to anyone else if you weren't sure that they spoke your language, right? There's nothing wrong with saying hello and smiling and just approaching the child, not being afraid.
Great. So get going straight away.
Yeah.
Approach the child. Don't be afraid. Try and engage in whichever communication method they're using.
Absolutely.
So just using a touch communication approach, as you mentioned earlier on.
And I think too, the don't be afraid thing, of course, certainly don't be afraid of the child, right? But also don't be afraid to get something wrong, because
there is no right or wrong here.
There's no right or wrong. Yeah. And no one expects it as a flawless interaction, right?
And to be honest, communication is already going on because you've made some sort of eye contact.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think there is an interaction taking place already.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, thinking about like, okay, what message do we send that child then? For example, in the example that you gave, mm-hmm. right? That child it has PMLD and is in a wheelchair and they're out at the grocery store with their mom and mom sees an old friend
mm-hmm.
and the friend addresses mom and kind of, you know, sympathetically grins and then walks away from the child. It's like, what message are we sending to the child then, right?
Yeah. Great. Okay. I know our time is running out soon, but I think it'd be really useful if we could talk a little bit about communication aids. Thinking about high tech and low tech, and when can we introduce that, and why?
Yeah.
Why do people with PMLD use communication aids?
Sure.
And what are communication aids?
Yeah. So great question. So I guess starting with the most basic. So what are communication aids? So communication aids, also referred to as alternative and augmentative communication, or AAC, are basically a means of supplementing communication that are not speech,
okay.
right? So they can include anything from, we mentioned PECs earlier, high-tech options like an iPad. It can be as simple as a picture, an object of reference, right? That's an example of a communication aid. Some children use communication books. So there's a humongous variety out there to supplement our child's communication, which is great. In terms of the low-tech options, I guess we'll talk about those first. So low-tech options for AAC are great because they're not cost-intensive and they're pretty easy to get up and running.
Okay.
And they're definitely something that parents can start to make and trial at home. So I suppose the easiest, most approachable part for a parent would be to use pictures or symbols, right? So using symbols along with when you're speaking to model to the child and give them that extra reinforcement of what it is they're hearing, right? So for example, we do this all the time with all children, right? With typically developing children with storybooks. We're reading along to them and we're also making reference to a visual to reinforce what it is that we're saying. And the same applies at a basic level to our children with PMLD, right? So one thing I like to do is use visuals throughout the day. So for example, when I come into the room, I have a little picture of myself and a little picture of a cartoon guy with an open mouth to let the kids know that it's time for speech and language therapy, right? So parents can really implement that flexibly throughout their time with their child.
And it is a routine that we would start off with low tech.
Yes.
And then as the child is developing and consolidating those skills, we would then move on to more high tech systems.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. So low tech is a great place to start. The reason why I like to start low tech with every single child is that there's really no consequence that would be negative to starting low tech and then very quickly realizing that the child's a high tech candidate.
Okay.
But there can be a tremendous amount of time, energy, and resources is wasted on the part of the family and the child if, for example, a high-tech option is purchased by the family right away without knowing that that's appropriate.
And when do we know somebody is ready for high-tech?
Yeah, so I would say most children become ready for high tech at the point where low tech options no longer serve their communication needs.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So when the child's communication skills are such that that for example, having a system where they have a communication book or pre-printed symbols, that is limiting to them because their communication abilities now are spontaneous and generative and they have more to say than they have symbols. And in cases like that, an iPad can be great because the child can navigate themselves through symbols and can add new symbols to their repertoire. So much more, it lends much more to, that generative and spontaneous piece.
Okay, well, thank you, Alana. It's been great having you come to the show.
It's been great.
And discussing how a speech and language therapist we can promote
Absolutely.
And support communication
yes.
with children and adults who have PMLD.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I would just like to plug is
sure.
if you are a speech and language therapist or aspiring speech and language therapist listening and you're interested in PMLD, I would definitely say don't be afraid to reach out to someone, right? So the community is really small and everyone is super passionate, enthusiastic. So I think it definitely does take a bit of self-initiation and drive to find a mentor. But if you think that this would be a good opportunity for you, definitely seek one out.
And how could our listeners reach out to you?
Yeah, so you can reach out to me via email. So alana@unlockinglanguage.co.uk. You can also reach me by phone, which you can, if you check our practice website, you can access it there.
On my website, www.unlockinglanguage.co.uk, you will find some resources that Alana has discussed today. There will be a template for a communication passport, a guide to using object of reference, and some general tips when communicating with children or adults who have PMLD. If you are a parent who has a baby or toddler newly diagnosed with PMLD, please do get a referral to speech and language therapy as soon as you can. Speak to your GP or your health visitor who will arrange for an NHS referral. If you are a teacher at a special school, again, it's really important to have a speech therapist to support the child's communication development, put all the key strategies in place, but also support access to learning. Speech and language therapy services can be commissioned by your local NHS trust or a local private speech and language therapist. Over the next few weeks, I'm hoping to cover the following topics: autism, communication difficulties in dementia, DLD, also known as developmental language delay, bilingualism and language development, and acquired communication disorders such as aphasia. Do drop me a line if you have any particular questions that you would like me to look into or any other topics that you would like covering. To get in touch with me, you can email me on info@unlockinglanguage.co.uk and follow me on social media. My Twitter handle is ulspeechtherapy, Instagram page is Shamina_Rabi, and Facebook page is Unlocking Language Speech Therapy. Thanks for listening today, and until the next episode, have a good week.